What do you do with the patient at the conclusion of the treatment if there's no change? Do you go into another form of therapy?
Well, typically they're either the same or worse since the drug doesn't have any immediate effects on this disease status. So I think we make decisions about treatment change in the same way as we would have had SIPT not been in the equation. Now, to get SIPT, you actually have to be progressing in some way. To get reimbursed, you have to document that at least the PSA is going up. So presumably, when you say the same, what you're describing is a patient in whom the PSA at least is continuing to go up. And in those patients, sooner or later, we would add some additional therapy. How soon is obviously a matter of debate. PSA is not an ideal marker for decision making. We all do rely on it probably more in clinic than we like to admit in public, but eventually we would start another therapy when the progression is convincing.
Rob?
One of the interesting things, and we've all experienced this, is when you take the time to have the discussion with the patient or their referring oncologist, and I've had this happen every other month for many years, the oncologists will call me post-SIPT when they return to their care, and they say, "How do you monitor the patient post-SIPT?" And this is such a difficult concept for people to get, which is why there's so much zeitgeist about this whole thing, is that the difference between applying a therapy which has an immune response possibility, which is a long-term issue, versus objective activity, is very difficult for oncologists to get their hands around. It was the first therapeutic vaccine approved. We have to change the way we think about managing disease as a chronic disease paradigm where we apply therapies based on, hopefully, rationale and science that may impact on survival. But this issue about what to do, how to manage it, it's all targeted around a marker, which we all acknowledge is a double-edged sword. It's good and bad, and sometimes it really hurts us. But this is useful to talk about. But at the end of the day, you can't think about it as a standard therapy. It's not.
Susan, and then Tom.
Yeah, just two points, and that is we've got to be very cautious about using the term immune response, because when we think about immune response is just not a signal of showing an antibody or a T cell activation or proliferation. Instead, it has to really be correlated with a change in the biology of the cancer. So while we might see that a PSA will go up or down, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a change in the metastatic disease that's there, that something has remitted or regressed completely. So, when we say immune response, one can easily be chastised just for using that without the concept that biology must be impacted upon. The second is that this is a tremendously biased group because we're all in academic centers that favor investigational trials. So if a patient is obviously thinking about Sipuleucel-T, they may opt for a drug that may give a faster response based on a clinical trial. The difference is, of course, that in the outside or the real world, people follow an algorithm. They know after this, they want to sequence that. And it's very different than the way we often think within academics.
Tom?
So in terms of describing how you take care of patients, and you guys will probably make fun of me for this, but I explain it a little bit like a very expensive and very complicated flu shot. On a population level, people got flu shots, do better. You don't know who actually benefited, and you don't really change anything you do after a flu shot. You keep taking care of them just the same as you would otherwise.
And they get the flu.
Well, yeah. They get the
All
flu
these
and
people
they blame
have
you
the flu.
because of the flu shot. The other analogy that you can use, although it's just because patients already have heard about it, is bone-directed therapies. I mean, when we talk about a bone-directed therapy like zoledronic acid or denosumab, the patient doesn't actually see that they're not going to get a fracture or another skeletal event. So we talk about it in the way that Rob said, that it's really about preparing the environment. So when I talk about this, I say that we're trying to boost your immune system. You won't see anything necessarily in the short term, but over the long term, we know that there's a survival benefit. And I think the more patients understand that because of this whole issue, the doctors don't always understand that. 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later, if they are expecting something that's different from that kind of milieu analogy, then they'll be very disappointed.
Mario, and then Dan.
I just wanted to point out something we haven't emphasized here. In our cancer immunology program, dealing with immunotherapy is one of the focus is timing of immunotherapy. It's possible that the interaction between immune modulation and other treatments may be important. For instance, immunizing a patient before you give hormonal therapy, before you give chemotherapy. So it is also possible that immunotherapy may enhance subsequent treatment. So, and how you demonstrate that, that's something that hasn't been really done systematically in all the trials, because the trials that treat patients prior to chemotherapy don't follow patients when they get chemotherapy, because there's no fixed point to initiate chemotherapy, and I think that will be an important thing. And one thing that Tom mentioned is the survival patients on the Dendron trial were 4 months compared to 2.2 months or 2.5 months on the TAX-327. We actually took those patients, matched them on the TAX-327 exactly the same way as they were on the Sopalusa-2 trial, by performance status, symptoms, hemoglobin, and there were about 198 or 199 patients on that category, Tom. And we found that the survival of those patients, if we were to give them docetaxel, was exactly the same. So the curves were absolutely superimposed. So it's a patient selection issue, and I'm not surprised that you're going to see a better survival if you treat patients who are asymptomatic, slowly progressing. I think that's what it is. So I think the jury is still out. I find it interesting. I don't have any problems if one chooses immunotherapy as a modality in patients who are minimally symptomatic, but I think that we don't really know how it works, where it works, and who benefits from it.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking more and more about what some of you have been saying about the objections you get from patients. I'm really wondering if that is really typical of what's happening, you know, sort of generally. I mean, you're not really eliminating any therapies. You're just adding one in. Patient's asymptomatic, and I understand the psychologic distress. Okay, you want to tell me about it, Matt?
Well, I think all the clinicians here know that the patient population we're talking about, metastatic CRPC, these are men in the last 2 to 3 years of their life for the most part. And nearly all of these men will succumb to their illness having received at most 2 or 3 of these 5 FDA-approved therapies. So what we're really talking about is prioritizing therapies and prioritizing sequence of therapies. And SIPT differs from the other 4 approved therapies in at least 2 of the 3 following ways. There's more uncertainty about mechanism of action. The OS benefit was seen in a single phase 3 trial. And that trial, even the IMPACT trial, was a modest size. And in contrast to every other agent, there is no evidence, no supportive evidence of benefit in any secondary outcome. This is the cause of all the zeitgeist and why I think the consistent message is going to be, yes, it has a role in selected patients, but most clinicians are not going to be highly enthusiastic about this therapy.
I think the last part of it is what I'm wondering if it's the patient or the clinician.
Both.
And I'm hearing, I guess, the answer to my question about how you integrate it is that it's down on the list for you.
And it's not simply addition. I think you suggested, well, it's just adding in another therapy. Well, that may be true if you look at a broad, yes, it is another therapy for the population of patients, but an individual patient with fatal prostate cancer is likely to receive at most 2 or 3 of these therapies. The clock is ticking. They have competing risks. They fall off the wagon when they develop other complications. So there is an opportunity cost to giving any therapy. You have eliminated another opportunity to receive therapy. So you can't underestimate the importance of this in a fatal disease.
So I've got to just dip a little bit more into this, and let me try to throw it around a different way. Maybe this would be more interesting. So Dan, about how many patients have you started on SIPT in the last year?
Probably about 30.
30?
Yep.
Matt?
6 or 8.
6 or 8. Tom?
10.
Oliver?
25.
William?
About 10.
Bob?
25.
Susan?
2.
2. I got to say, I'm surprised. I'm feeling a lot of skepticism in the room, and those numbers, I know you see a lot of patients, but those are not inconsequential numbers.